Golf Smarter, number 353, published on October 16, 2012, is brought to you by Bonobos.com. Stylish, comfortable golf clothes, free shipping on your purchase, free shipping on all returns, and now Bonobos offers guide shops in three U.S. locations where you can try on the clothes, then have them delivered to your home. Click on their ad at golfsmarter.com or go to bonobos.com, spelled B-O-N-O-B-O-S. Get 20% off your first purchase when you use the checkout code, in person or online, Golf Smarter. Also, in our Score Zone Short Game Academy, Terry Kaler gives a score 41-61 money club to the listener who asked his advice on touch versus feel in the short game.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
Golf's greatest upset at the 1955 U.S. Open with author Neil Sagabelle.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Neil.
Good to be here, Fred. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for reaching out and mentioning in LinkedIn that you had this book, because it was kind of perfect for the Golf Smarter podcast. And for some interesting reason, I thought it was perfect for 2012, because this sports year has had its own list of upsets, and we can get into more about that in a minute. But most recently in golf, the 2012 Ryder Cup, I don't know if it was necessarily an upset, but it was an amazing comeback and a long shot at best on Sunday. But we also had the U.S. Open in San Francisco at the Olympic Club here in 2012. And your story talks about the U.S. Open back in 1955.
Yeah. Well, this year, this was the fifth Open play at the Olympic Club. The one in 1955 was the first, and that's where Hogan and Fleck showed up and all the other greats of that era. And interestingly, it was only the second U.S. Open played on the West Coast. So up until that time, the U.S. Open had been more or less an East Coast championship.
Most sports are East Coast-centric, at least from the writer's perspective. What was the first event played on the West Coast? Do you remember?
The first U.S. Open played on the West Coast was at Riviera.
Oh, down in Los Angeles.
And Ben, it was the first U.S. Open that Ben Hogan won.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. So let's set this up, because during the TV broadcast of the 2012 U.S. Open, there was a lot of talk about Jack Fleck and, you know, like they love to go into the history of it. But specifically, Ben Hogan at the time was dominant. He was... it was just a given that Ben Hogan would be there at the end battling for the title or just running away with it. And this was the case again. But it had been, for those who aren't familiar, it had been a tumultuous time for Ben Hogan leading up to this. Let's start with some background about the big boy. Let's give us some background about Ben Hogan.
Well, a lot of people who follow golf have heard of Hogan for sure, because I think he revolutionized the game in a few different ways. And part of that was because I think it was not easy for him to make it out there on the PGA Tour. We know of him as a great player now, but he struggled. He was not as talented as guys like, say, Byron Nelson, who came out of the same caddy yard as Hogan. So he really had to work to hone his golf swing. He fought a hook as a younger player, and it took him three tries really to catch on the PGA Tour. He didn't win his first tournament until 1940, so he'd been out there a while. And he didn't win his first major until 1946. And I can't remember, so that would have made him, I guess, almost, well, he's probably about 34 years old. So it took Hogan a while, and there's that famous saying of finding the secret in the dirt. He found his swing through a lot of practice And no one, I don't know if up until that point in time anyone had worked harder to develop his golf swing or develop his game than Ben Hogan. So he's famous for his work ethic. About the time that he was really coming into his own, Byron Nelson retired in 1946. He was really considered the top man in golf. But Hogan was coming along. Snead was a great as well, Sam Snead. About the time Hogan was really starting to get it, he won the PGA Championship in 46. He won his first U.S. Open in 1948 at Riviera in Los Angeles. He had that terrible car accident in early 1949. He was coming back from Arizona, I think it was the Phoenix Open, with his wife, and he was driving home to Fort Worth. And they were on a foggy West Texas highway, and a Greyhound bus had pulled out to pass a truck. And Hogan and his wife in their Cadillac had a head-on collision that they were just... It was a miracle that they both survived it. And Hogan was in a hospital for 2 months and almost died. And when he came out of that hospital, his doctors never really thought he'd play golf again. He was fortunate to be walking around. But he was a very driven man, and he made a comeback. What some, I think, to this day consider maybe one of the greatest, if not the greatest, comebacks in the history of sports. Something less than 2 years after he had this accident, he came back and he won the U.S. Open in 1950 at Marion. And so we see this Hogan who, now he's, because of his physical condition, he has to go through this regimen just to play. Prepare himself to play. He'd soak in a hot tub with Epsom salts. He took aspirin. He had to rub liniment on his legs and wrap his legs in elastic bandages. And after this accident, he only plays in about 6 or 7 tournaments a year. But he becomes this machine of a golfer who is incredibly tough and determined in the major championships. So after Hogan has his accident, he actually goes on to win more majors than he'd won before that. And coming into the 1955 U.S. Open at Olympic, he'd won 4 of the last 6 U.S. Opens he'd played in, which is pretty remarkable. And he'd won 9 majors total. And in 1953, he had probably one of the greatest years in golf that any professional golfers ever had. He won what they ended up calling the Hogan Slam. He won the Masters, the U.S. Open, and the British Open, and I believe all by record scores.
Amazing.
And they called it the Hogan Slam, and it was at a time when the PGA Championship was, it overlapped the British Open, and you couldn't play both, really. Hogan, they might not have been played during the same week, but because of travel, I can't remember if Hogan took a boat over to Scotland or if he flew, but it was hard. From a practical standpoint, you couldn't play in both. So he went and played the British.
The British and the PGA Championship were happening at the same time that year? Is that true? And that's why he couldn't play in all 4?
They were either happening at the same time or they were so close together that it wasn't practical for him to get back in time to play the PGA. The PGA was a match play championship at that time.
Okay.
And I don't remember how many matches you had to play to win it, but you had to play several matches.
Actually, I just found it up on Wikipedia, and that year in 53, first of all, Hogan was 40 at the time, which is amazing in itself when you look at today's players. But in 1953, the PGA Championship was from July 1st to 1 through 7, and the Open Championship played at Carnoustie that year was July 6th through 10. So they did overlap.
Yeah.
So getting the Hogan Slam, he wasn't given the opportunity to get the Grand Slam.
Yeah, and that terminology, I don't really know from my research what they were saying, if that was something that people were even talking about at that time, you know, calling it the Grand Slam. But he won, he was Professional Athlete of the Year, not just golfer. In 1953, there was something called the Hickok Belt, maybe you've heard of, or maybe some of your listeners have heard of. He was awarded to the top professional athlete of the year, and Hogan won it in 1953 because he had this remarkable year where he won three majors, and I think he played in six tournaments and he won five. So, and he never went back to the British Isles. He went there once, he won it, and that was it. It was
been there, done that.
A lot of Americans didn't play in the British Open in those days. It typically costs more to go over there and play it than you got out of it. And only some of Hogan's professional friends said, "Ben, you need to go over there and play that to be considered, you know, a kind of a full career. And as the great player you are, you need to do it." And so he did, and he won at Carnoustie.
Mm-hmm. He really defies what we know today, and just it's amazing that he was able to come back with, you know, the way science and medicine is today, what they could have done for him, but he was in a lot of pain, he was limping, and he made it work. I mean, and then he came back and played better than ever.
Yeah,
truly incredible story. Truly an incredible story of a comeback. So here he is now. He won in 53. He had that the Hogan Slam in 53, 54. He doesn't win any majors. 1955, he is expected to dominate again. And they come to San Francisco, but there's something that gets in the way of his victory there. There's another character. Give us the background on Jack Fleck.
Well, Jack Fleck is a totally different golfer. In 1955, he's one of the guys that's in the field playing these tournaments, but he's not well known. He's never won on tour. He's mostly been what I'd call a winter tour player, meaning he was a club pro. He had two clubs he managed in Iowa, and from say late December to early April, he'd go play the winter tour out in California, Arizona, Texas, and Louisiana up until the time when golf season opened at his home courses in the beginning of April. And there were a lot of guys that did that. It was tough to play the full tour. There just wasn't that much money. So he had tournament experience, but he wasn't really known, and he was a middle-of-the-pack player. He'd make cuts, and he could finish in the top 20, and he might make a few checks, but he was trying to see if he was good enough, really, to play out there. And at the end of the 1954 season, he and his wife had a talk, and she said, "Why don't you give it 2 years and see if you can play the full tour and see if you can succeed out there and make enough money to make it worthwhile." By this time, Jack's 33 years old, so he's going to find out.
You know what, Neil? You make it sound so gentle. Why don't you know his wife saying, "Why don't you give it 2 years?" I gotta believe anybody who's married for any period of time's gotta believe that it wasn't that simple. Of, "Oh, why don't you just give it 2 years?" It was more like, "All right, you got 2 years. If you don't get it done, then it's time to change course." Did your research show that she was that genteel about it?
Well, it was all from Jack because she's gone now.
Right.
No, you're right. I'm saying that in my tone and my style of speech.
Yeah.
I think it probably was more of a challenge to him.
Sure.
But you know, I think it was, in fact, when you read the book, you'll see a quote from her where she says, go out there and find out if you can play tournament golf the full circuit, and if you can't, you'll at least get it out of your system, quoted in the journal. Now, she ran the golf courses for him while he was gone, along with his assistant pro.
Interesting.
So she was, I would say that she was an encouraging influence. And if you were talking to Jack Fleck today, he'd probably tell you that she kind of pushed him out there and said, Jack, just go find out, okay? Just you wanna find out if you can play, go try it and give it 2 years. And if you don't, hey, you're just going to come back to Iowa and be a club pro, and that's the way it's going to be. And there are a lot of guys like that. It was really hard to play.
She said, you know, Jack, just go find out. So if you can pick it up right around there, I'll clean it up and edit it.
I think you're right about what you said, Fred, that she did. It was sort of a challenge to him. And she said, Jack, get out there and go find out. And if you can't make it in 2 years, you'll get playing tournament golf out of your system. So it was a challenge. And he had said to her at the end of the 54 season, just privately, something he told me, and it's also in the book, he wanted to see if he could play what he called championship golf before Hogan and Snead retired. So he looked up to those guys, and I think he wanted to see if he could play at that level. Now, he wasn't going to be Hogan or Snead, but he wanted to be able to see if he could really compete and play better than he'd played up to that point. So this was his shot. It really was his chance, his window of opportunity to go try to play the full tour.
Had he played in a major before?
Yes, he had. He played where, you know, whereas Hogan comes into 55, he's won 4 U.S. Opens and finished very high in many of the others that he played in. Jack Fleck's only played in 2. He's only played in 2. And the first one was in 1950, where Hogan made that miracle comeback. It's the first Open that Jack played in. He missed the cut. And then Jack played again in 1953, which was a part of Hogan's Slam year, where he won the 3 majors, and that was at Oakmont. And in that one, Jack finished something like, I think he finished 52nd, 26 shots behind Ben Hogan. So he's played. In 54, he tried to qualify, but he didn't qualify, so he didn't play in 54. And he had to qualify in 55. This is an era where pretty much the whole field has to qualify just to get into the U.S. Open. There aren't all the exemptions that there are now to get into the field. You're looking at all but 17 players who qualified around the country to get into the field.
So talk about the qualification process.
There were 17 players that were exempt into the 1955 U.S. Open field out of 162 that started. So from that, you can just imagine that you have all these players qualifying. And a lot of them are really great players. They're players that have been playing on the tour and winning money. But you didn't have the exemptions like you do now, you know, where there's all this different criteria for getting in, whether you're in the top 50 in the world and all these other things.
So, plus the money, you know, probably, well, definitely the money wasn't like it is today. But if you were probably out of the top, what, 5, top 10, that you really didn't win anything?
That's exactly right. So what you had in 55, the guys that were in were the last 5 players to win the U.S. Open, the players who had finished in the top 10 in 1954, they're in, and then you have the winners of the U.S. Amateur and the British Amateur, they're in. And I think that pretty much covers the criteria for being exempt into the 1955 U.S. Open field. And that ends up being about 17 players. The other, I'm going to try to do math here. The other 145 players have to qualify. These are pros and amateurs, club pros, guys who've been playing the tour. They're qualifying at locations around the country. There were a total of over 1,500 that went to qualifying for 145 spots around the country.
Wow.
Jack qualified in the Chicago sectional. And there might have been, I don't know, 100 or a few more in that sectional and maybe 6-7 spots. So it was, as some of the players told me, it was just an honor. You had to be a great golfer just to play in the U.S. Open. A lot of guys felt like just getting to the tournament, playing in it, was a huge honor. And they were just, it said that they were a good golfer just being in the tournament.
Mm. And that actually could turn into a lot of work for them in those days. Just to be able to say that they qualified for the tournament, they can become the pro for at a club for life. And really that was probably a more secure profession at the time, if you talk about that being a profession, than being a touring golfer.
That's absolutely correct, because there just wasn't the money in
right.
professional golf, playing tournament golf. I mean, there were the purses ranged from, this is total purses for the whole field. They might range from about $10,000 to $30,000.
Wow.
The winner would get anywhere from $2,000 to $5,000 was the winning check. And all the guys, you know, guys that are in the Hall of Fame now that I got to talk to, they said it was just tough. It was tough playing out there. You could, you know, I talked to Arnold Palmer. You could make the cut and not earn a check. There were only about 30 money places in a lot of tournaments. So you could make the cut and not get a check. Jack Fleck tells a story where, I don't know, I think it might have been the 1953 San Diego Open. He finished, I think, 27th. And his check for the week was $13.75. And after he paid his caddy for the week, $21 or $22, he came out, you know, $8 in the hole.
That's not good. That's not a way to make a living. You could hear why the wife would be going, okay, yeah, you got this much time, and then you're getting back to work.
Yeah, so, you know, even the top players, Ben Hogan, Sam Snead, Jimmy Demare, Lloyd Mangrum, Curry Middlecoff, Julius Poros, these top players, they all had club jobs, too. And mm-hmm. some of them were more, some of the top players like Hogan maybe didn't have to spend a lot of time at the club to earn his check. But that did augment their income because there just wasn't a lot of money to be made at the tournaments. And then if you're a top player, too, there were some endorsements and equipment contracts and things like that, but they weren't anywhere close to the
yeah.
level they are.
Yeah, the endorsement thing really didn't get going until, what, the 90s or something when I guess Michael Jordan really put it over the top. But also the endorsements from the Olympics were in Los Angeles in 84. And Uberoth really got the official sponsor. So it was a very different, sports marketing was a very different beast in 1955 than it is in 2012.
It was. And a lot of these players, too, made their money and made it from town to town and tournament to tournament by playing money games in between the tournaments. You know, playing the best player of that in that area or the best player at the club. Where they were playing, and they'd play in some big money games, and some of them made a lot more money, not when they weren't playing tournaments than when they were. You know, I went down to Hickory, North Carolina, just last week to see Jack Fleck and some of these other legends because they were up there playing a pro-am at Hickory, which is where the Champions Tour event was. Fred Funk won yesterday. But I was sitting next to a guy who, I don't know if he's a good friend of Doug Sanders. And Doug Sanders was a great player, a little later era than Black. He came along more in the late 50s and early 60s, and he won a lot of tournaments, and he very nearly won the British Open. He missed a short putt at St. Andrews in 1970, and he ended up in a playoff with Jack Nicklaus and lost. That's what a lot of people remember about Doug Sanders. But
sounds like this, another book for you.
Yeah, this fellow I met, speaking of this income situation back in those days, he told me that Doug Sanders made a lot more money playing gin rummy than he did playing golf, because he said numbers like $25,000, $30,000, $50,000 playing gin rummy when he wasn't out on the golf course.
Oh, wow.
So that's just one example, but they hustled, you know, they kind of hustled.
He was just a guy looking for a game. Doesn't matter what it was, right?
He was. Yeah, and a lot of them were like that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Interesting. So now there's a couple ways I want to go with this, and I want to see which you're more comfortable with starting, because I'm going to try to get you to do both. I want to go talk about the different people that you interviewed and their recollections of that weekend and how things went. But I also would love if you could take us through. Now, was it a 3 or 4 day tournament at that time?
It was a 3 day tournament. Which ended up having a 4th day because of the playoff.
Right. So when they would play 4 rounds over the 3 days, right?
That's right. They played 4 rounds over the 3 days.
Right.
They played 36 on the final day.
Unbelievable. And Ben Hogan now has to walk that 36 holes too, which is,
he does.
For him, it's painful enough just to walk a golf course, let alone walk 36 holes, let alone walk 36 holes in San Francisco at the Olympic Club, which is not what you call a flat golf course.
No, it wasn't easy for him to walk. And he kind of complained. I mean, his legs tired. They were stiff. It wasn't easy to walk that course because it's definitely sloping terrain.
So I would love, so the part two of that was not only talk about the people that you interviewed and the research that you did for the book, but to go each day through the tournament and what was going on and what were the high points and the low points that led us to that final day when, you know, on the final round when everyone thought it was over and that Hogan had just, it was done. And the networks. You know, the broadcast element of this story is also very interesting.
Yes,
so,
it is.
But so how do you want to pursue that? Which way do you want to go with this?
I'll go either way.
Oh,
I mean,
gee,
I
thanks.
Can talk about who I talk to. I can try to go back through it day by day and tell you, give you some snippets and tell you what happened on those days, what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. But I think I think that's how we climax this story, is the day by day. I would like to talk about your research process, the people you talk to, and what they remember about how the weekend proceeded. You know, one of the all-time favorite T-shirts I've ever heard about was the swim team, who was a collegiate swim team that was highly decorated in the 40s, I think it was. And, you know, every year they would get together and have a reunion. And I think for their one of the major anniversaries, they had T-shirts that were made that said, "The older we get, the faster we were." And,
yeah.
And so I've got to believe that some of the stories that you heard were embellished a little more than others. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting for me, Fred, because I hadn't written a book before. And so, you know, in some cases, well, you have to sift through and try to understand this. I don't know that any player I talked to was intentionally trying to embellish anything.
Okay.
I just think maybe through the fog of time, you remember things differently. And first of all, this book really focuses on Jack Fleck. And, of course, Ben Hogan's gone, and I never got a chance to talk to him. And he wasn't much for talking to writers and reporters late in his life anyway, so I probably would have never talked to Ben Hogan. Hmm. But I can tell you this, Jack Fleck was totally straight with me. He's a very kind of black and white person. If he didn't remember something, he didn't try. He didn't try to sort of create something for me. He'd just tell me. And one of the things that was interesting to me was Jack didn't really remember a lot of details about the first, second, and third rounds. He had some overall remembrances about playing maybe certain holes and about overall feelings he had about how he played that day and what he shot. But he couldn't take me shot by shot or hole by hole in any of that.
Well, that's interesting. Because I'm always blown away when athletes can go, oh, you know, and they say, well, what about that approach shot on 14 on Friday? And they're like, they know exactly what they're talking about. And I would look at them like, I don't know. It blows me away that they can remember specifics like that. So I'm glad to hear that Fleck was going, eh.
He would just tell me, I don't remember. And so one of the challenges for me as a writer was, how do I recreate this tournament
right
for everyone and what happened and make you feel like you were there? But secondly, since it's going to really focus on Fleck and Hogan, how do I tell you about Fleck's first few rounds when he couldn't tell me a lot about them? Fortunately, that's where my research came in. There was a lot of newspaper coverage. The Olympic Club, where I went, the historian had information. I was able to get my hands on the pairing sheet for that week, the hole-by-hole scores. I knew the course pretty well from what was written about it. It's a different course now, but it's, you know, there are a lot of features about it that are the same, but it was a very different course in 55. Mm-hmm. I had a lot of good information, and plus the newspaper coverage told me things about Fleck in the first, second, and third rounds, as well as the other players. So I used what I had, and it was a considerable amount of information.
Hmm. Well, Neil, I hate to interrupt you here, but we've kind of reached our time limit for the Golf Smarter podcast, and I would I have a lot more questions because I've just set you up with telling us the story about that weekend. Could you stick around and we can do a part two and make this a members-only conversation?
Sure, I'd love to.
Awesome, thank you. So then let me remind the Golf Smarter audience and let you know that if you'd like to hear part two of this conversation and get the full story of that weekend, as best we can determine from the stories that were told to Neil, Neil Sagabelle is the author of the book The Longest Shot, subtitled Jack Fleck, Ben Hogan, and Pro Golf's Greatest Upset at the 1955 U.S. Open. It is available as a Kindle book, correct? It's a digital,
yeah.
Yes, and it's also on hard copy as well.
Yes.
And we have it in our Golfers Mart at golfsmarter.com, so you can just go ahead and purchase it for yourself right there, whether you do the download version or you have it ordered as a gift for you or somebody else this holiday season. Purchase the book. It's a great story. It's an amazing story. And it's timely, mainly because of the Olympic Club and the upsets and golf in general. So, Neil, thank you for agreeing to stick around. And I, again, encourage everyone to join Golf Smarter for members only so you can hear part two of this conversation. Neil, you're sticking around, right?
I am. Thanks. And thanks so much. I appreciate being on with you.
Hey, time is running out on the 20% discount from Bonobos. That's right. As a Golf Smarter listener, you get a full 20% off your entire purchase the first time you shop at Bonobos.com. Bonobos hasn't been around that long, but they're definitely getting noticed by the fashion and the retail world. That's because they're setting new standards in how the clothing business is done. Choose from a great selection of athletic men's clothing, including a line specifically designed for the golfer. Purchase as much as you'd like. Use the checkout code GOLFSMARTER. Take 20% off your entire order and get free shipping. Once you get your clothes, try them all on, do the entire fashion show thing with your partner, and don't forget to ask, does this make my butt look big? And then get free shipping on anything you don't want, or make an exchange to try on something different or a different size. And Bonobos will cover the shipping costs every time. But the Golf Smarter offer doesn't last forever, so make your purchase now. If you're in Northern California, stop by their guide shop in Palo Alto and try on the clothes first. They also have guide shops in Boston and New York City. Bonobos.com, that's B-O-N-O-B-O-S, Bonobos.com, or click on their ad at GolfSmarter.com. It's time once again to welcome back Terry Kaler, the CEO of Score Golf, and it's our Score Zone Short Game Academy. You can participate in this part of the program, and we encourage you to click on the Score Zone Short Game Academy button at GolfSmarter.com and submit your question, because if your question is answered on this segment by Terry, you will receive a money club of your choice, custom fit for you by Score Golf. And Terry will give you more information. What do we mean by a money club? Because he just doesn't like to use the W word anymore. Terry, how are you? Welcome back.
I'm great, friend. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for asking. So we get a question here today from Joe Dolan of Wazin, Ohio. And he says, look, if I'm, say, about 80 yards from the pin with an open green in front of me, and I'm between clubs, a 60 degree or a 56 degree, in between those two, is it better for me to hit a hard 60 degree club or take some off of the 56 degree? And that's his question. And my comment is, I've never even understood how to take it off or hit it hard. You know, it's like, to me, the swing, if you swing harder, you're swinging, that's, you don't want to swing harder, you know? And
well,
so where, I'd love to get your feedback on this too.
Well, I think the concept of hitting wedges hard is something you never want to do. And one of the things about hitting your high loft golf clubs, and I said the W word because he's playing wedges and he's not playing scoring clubs, but shameless plug. But anyway, so
no, that's okay.
Hitting,
it's, you
when
can
you're
be shameless.
Trying to hit, when you're trying to hit a high lofted club harder, invariably what's going to happen is you increase your club head speed. All that weight low along the club is going to launch that ball higher, and it's going to end up going shorter. And I think most of your readers can say, yeah, I mean, I remember that. I was trying to kind of get on that 56 a little bit or get on that gap wedge a little bit, and I felt the ball hit a little higher on the club head, and I swung harder, but the ball went higher and shorter. These clubs are really hard to control distance with when you get more than about an 80% swing. So, you know, you really want to put the controlled pace swing on your high loft golf clubs, just in general, regardless whether it's a 60 or a 54 or a 58 or a 52, whatever it is in your hand. You put a high loft club in your hand, throttle back your swing speed. That your full swing needs to be redefined from what it is with a 7-iron or a 5-iron or a fairway or hybrid or driver particularly. So the first part of developing good short range performance is to get the right arsenal of clubs in your bag. And Joe talked about he's caught between a 56 and a 60. Get the right club, have 4-degree gaps, maybe 5 if you're a shorter hitter, and then go out and learn what really is a textbook 56, a textbook 60, a textbook 52, whatever lofts you're carrying. Find out what distance you can produce with that controlled swing. Rather than think about hitting it, taking something off, as Joe says, or hitting a hard, you know, the lower club harder, I wrote a book a number of years ago called, a little booklet called The Score Method. And what I showed you how to do in that, it's free for download on our site at scoregolf.com. You can poke around, you can find this download. But what The Score Method is all about, once you have understood your, quote, full swing distances with these clubs, you can then dissect those, and you should have 12 to 13, 14 yard gaps in your full swing with your scoring clubs. Then you can dissect those gaps by changing your hand position. So if you grip down on that 56, for example, a half an inch to 3/4 of an inch, you're going to see about 3 yards come off of that distance. Go down an inch, you're going to see about cut in half the gap between that club and the next lower club. So now you've taken your 3 or 4 high loft clubs, and you've given yourself 6 or 8, quote, full swing distances. So now you've dissected your gaps. You can then dissect those gaps a little more by learning how to open the face just a little bit or close the face just a little bit. It adds a little loft, adds a little spin. There, again, I wrote this booklet called The Score Method that really dives into deep detail on how to do this. And Joe, what it does for you and for all the listeners out there is it takes away this take a little off or jump on it a little bit, and you say, hey, I'm a 80 yards. I know that's a 56-degree grip down a half an inch. Just hit it, and it's going to be within 2 or 3 yards of that 80 number. Or, you know, it's 71 yards, and I know that's a 60-degree grip down an inch with the face hooded just a hair. And you learn how to change the relationship between your swing and the club to build these yardages in versus take a little off or jump on it a little bit.
So, Terry, how does this all fall into the feel versus method? You know, there's a lot of conversation. There's even a lot of questions that we've been receiving from people on this very topic when it comes to the short game. You know, when you have wedge, pitching, chipping, even putting, the feel versus method, how do you interpret that?
Well, I think, first of all, let's talk about feel. You have to have some feel of the golf club and the golf ball, how the ball comes off the club. I mean, that's just essential to golf. And you get that through hitting a lot of golf shots. You also have to have a method that you can rely on. I mean, Dave Phelps has got a very complex method for 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock, all this kind of stuff. And you can spend a lot of time learning that if you want. I take a little simpler approach because most people aren't going to spend the amount of time. Or if they're not going to spend the amount of time. And I look and say, learn what I was just talking about with the score method. Learn your bracket of full swing yardages and then go and practice a half swing. And just learn, and this is kind of the feel thing. And to me, a half swing is, you know, if you're a right-handed player, your left arm goes back to parallel to the ground. So your hands are about shoulder high, you know, behind you. And that half swing, you know, you can take your golf clubs and you can practice that half swing and see what your 60 does with a half swing and your 56 and your 52 and even down into your pitch, your 9. And again, chart those yardages and know, you know, that's a half swing 60 laid open a little bit like this. You can assist your scoring range performance to whatever you want. The feel comes in when you get down less than that. And that's really letting your eye-hand coordination take out. And what I like to do is hit most of my pitch shots with some to a half swing because it's long enough to give you them. And I developed a little method that I've shared with people and they really like it. And that is once you really learn this half swing, now you can inject what I call the third element. And that's really the feel element, the speed element. So what's really a fun exercise, and it's very eye-opening, and it adds a lot of versatility to your short-range performance, is to go practice that half swing at 3 different speeds. And I use driving as kind of an analogy. So I have a half swing at country road speed, which is 50 miles an hour, 55 miles an hour, well under highway speed. It's not full throttle. It's just a nice, you know, kind of a power pace, but well under control. And then I practice that half swing at what I call city driving. So it's the same half swing, but it's a slower pace. It's more careful. It's more cautious, like when you're driving in the city. And then I have school zone. So I'm still going into a half swing, but I'm slowing everything down to the very careful, precise driving I would do in the school zone where little kids might jump out in front of me. So if that's, to me, the way to gauge feel is to think of feel as a pace rather than how hard to hit it. Think about what your pace of your swing is going to be. So now you have created, with a fun exercise that didn't take hours and hours, you've created multiple distances with each club through this full swing exercise of gripping down and laying the face open just a hair. You've created another whole set of yardages with your half swing at regular full swing speed, and then another few things you can do by varying your swing pace from this country road to city driving to school zone. That's a lot for one little podcast session, Fred, but I think that there's a big picture here of how to build a system that uses the feel you brought to the golf course, because everybody has eye-hand coordination. Everybody has that. And you use those qualities that you have and just a little bit of regimentation in hand position on the grip and learning this half swing and developing these free paces, or only two if you want, but you develop a faster pace and a slower pace, and all of a sudden you have a whole arsenal of shots to use inside 9-iron range.
Awesome. Thank you. I can't wait to go out and start trying this now. We've talked about tour tempo on here numerous times, and last time he was on, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on his name right now, but last time he was on, it'll come to me. We talked about how, you know, the rhythm, the pace, the tempo of the short game is a 1-to-1 versus the 3-to-1 that he has on a full swing. And I realized in practicing that in my short game, especially in chipping, I speed things up. And when you speed things up, you also get a tighter grip, you tense your shoulders up. But when I slow it down and get that nice 1-to-1 pace, bump, 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 you know, everything works a little bit better. And so combining that, you know, lesson with what you just provided just kind of cleans it all up for me.
Well, and that, I'm glad I was able to do that. I think that the thing to keep in mind, the closer you get to the flag, the slower you work. It becomes more of a precision game, and I always tell the story, I think I've already bored your listeners with the idea of painting a house, but when you're laying on the big areas of paint, you work fast, you work with a power sprayer, you work with a big power roller, and it's just get the paint on, and you work with speed and power. That's your tee game and your long ball and even in your middle irons. The closer you get to doing the trim work to finish off that paint job, the slower and more meticulous you are. And so I kind of liken that to the way to play a hole and of golf, is that the closer you get to the flag, the lower and slower and more precise you get, the more meticulous you get, because, you know, you're trying to get it in the hole. It's just kind of nice thing to keep you thinking kind of slow around the greens, is just slow everything down.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that,
like driving in a parking lot versus a freeway. How's that?
There you go. I'm kind of stuck on the painting thing. So that is our Score Zone Short Game Academy with Terry Kaler. And that's what we do on each Golf Smarter episode. And you can participate, because if we answer your question, you will not only get a custom fit Score 4161 money club, but you will also get a Golf Smarter World's Greatest Divot Tool. So please participate. But also, if your question has been answered, you know, the one that was in your head, and you don't want to write in, that's okay, because you can just get your discount by being a Golf Smarter listener. Golf Smarter listeners get a 10% discount with the code Golf Smarter. Golf Smarter members, they get a 15% discount on their purchases. And to get the code for that, you have to go to the members only website. And if you're not a member, wow, I'm telling you, it's going to, joining up to Golf Smarter members, that extra 5% on your discount is going to get reimbursed really quickly. So we thank Score Golf and Terry. We thank you very much for the support of Golf Smarter Podcast, helping us stay alive, and really enjoy the lesson. Thanks so much, bud.
Well, we always enjoy it. I look forward to the next show.
Up next for Members Only, part two on golf's greatest upset at the 1955 U.S. Open with Neil. Please become a member today and take advantage of these great discounts, a new episode each week, and complete access to over 7 years of Golf Smarter interviews. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the Hey Fred button at golfsmarter.com.
SmarterPodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.